All right. Thank you for coming. I feel like every year I feel like the Yomi Yun at Mayanote represents so much of what is wonderful about this school. So I look forward to it, and I'm so glad you came to learn with me. Okay, so tonight I would like to talk about Tefillat Chana and Rosh Hashanah Shechalios B'Shalos, beginning with Tefillat Chana. At first glance, it appears when we start reading the story of Chana that the story of Chana is not groundbreaking in any way. If anything, the story seems to be a reworking of some themes and ideas and stories that we're already very familiar with. It seems like she is parallel to many of the stories of Nashim Akarot in Tanakh, particularly of the Imahot in Chumash. It's the Haftarah, after the Kriyas HaTorah that day of the first day of Rosh Hashanah is V'Hashem Pakad Et Sarah. And this seems to be, parallel type of story. Even more so, Chana seems to be very similar in many ways to the story of Rachel, in that they're both in the particular situation of being the favored wife who doesn't have children, in contrast to the less favored wife, the sort of live-in rival who does have children. Another way that the story of Chana seems to recap other stories and remind us of things we've read already is that in addition to being parallel to the stories of Nashim Akarot in Chumash, the story of Chana also seems to be a continuation of the end of Sefer Shoftim. It seems in many ways to recap some of the ideas in the end of Sefer Shoftim, and particularly of the last two stories in Sefer Shoftim, the two disastrous episodes of Pilegesh Begiva and Pesel Micha. So linguistically, if you look at the first source on the sheet, there are a number of linguistic parallels between those stories and the story of Chana, the beginning of Shmuel Aleph. Pesel Micha begins with the pasuk Vayhi ish mehar Ephraim ushmo Michaihu. And similarly, Pilegesh Begiva begins with Vayhi bayimim him melech in B'Yisrael, Vayhi ish levi gar biyarketei har Ephraim. Again, someone who introduces us to a protagonist who lives in har Ephraim. So too, the beginning of Sefer Shmuel begins with Vayhi ish echem min haramatayim sofim mehar Ephraim. So once again, it's reminding us of these stories. It seems to be a continuation of what we've just finished reading. So too, in the end of Sefer Shoftim, the Tanakh says that Hinei Chag Hashem b'Shilo miyamim yamima, that there was a Chag for Hashem and Shiloh periodically, and our Sefer as well begins already in Pasuk Gimel by saying that Elkanah went me'iro miyamim yamima lishtachvul izbach Hashem tzvakot b'Shiloh. Right, that it reminds us of that story as well in describing this periodic celebration and Chag for Hashem in Shiloh. So even just the fact that our Sefer begins with a Vav, as the Abarbanel points out, also seems to connect it explicitly to the previous Sefer, to Shoftim. So in other words, the opening seven psukim or so of Sefer Shmuel seem deliberately constructed to make us feel as if we're about to read something that's sort of already somewhat familiar, themes and ideas and stories that we've encountered before in other ways. But in fact, the story of Chana really represents a fundamental turning point in a number of ways. On the national level, it's very clear that while the story seems linguistically to parallel the Sefer Shoftim, it's actually entirely different in the sense that Shoftim is all about the moral anarchy that Bnei Yisrael experienced when there was no king, whereas Sefer Shmuel represents the beginning of the monarchy and a period of national stability. And also, even if when compared to the stories of the Nashim Akarot in Chumash, there are some fundamental differences. Chana actually represents sort of a radical new approach to tefillah and to avodat Hashem. So I think that the reason that the beginning of the Sefer deliberately creates this impression that we're about to read something that's just sort of like same old, is in order to very shortly sort of slam us with the uniqueness that Chana actually represents. It's a more dramatic literary effect when we expect one thing and then instead experience something entirely different. So, first of all, it's very clear how nationally this represents a turning point, so I don't think we need to even discuss that. The beginning of the monarchy is clearly a total change from what happened during Sefer Shoftim. What's less clear is how personally and religiously Chana's avoda represents a turning point, and that's what I'd like to explore in more detail. So first of all, even though Chana's situation seems at first glance to be the same as that of the Avot and Imahot, there's actually a very fundamental difference. The Gemara very famously, Rabbi Yitzchak very famously says in the Gemara in Yevamos that the reason that Hashem afflicted the Avos and Imahos with infertility was because Metava HaKadosh Baruch Hu L'Tfilatam Shel Tzadikim, and Hashem wanted their tefillot. But the question remains as to why he chose this nisayon in particular. I mean, he could have made them poor, but in fact they were very wealthy people. He could have struck them with sickness. He could have chosen any one of a number of nisyonot. But in fact, he struck them with infertility. And this is even more noteworthy given the fact that Hashem had already promised the Avot and Imahot that they would have children, that they would be the beginning of a nation. So in other words, it seems that they really knew that ultimately they were going to have children because Hashem had promised it. So when they daven, it's in order to help that come true, perhaps by making themselves, by transforming themselves in some way so that they're more worthy of the fulfillment of that promise. But in a way, they already know what the outcome is going to be because they have a promise from God that it's going to happen. In a way, it seems it would have been a stronger nisayon to give them some type of something to live through. They didn't already know how it was going to turn out in the end.
Yeah.
One of the things that was uncertain for a while is whether the children would be from Sarah.
Right, so there are cases, absolutely.
First he took Hagar and...
Absolutely. And there are cases, we're actually going to discuss that now, there are cases where it's not clear exactly how it's going to happen. That's for sure. When it comes to the Imahot, it's a little different. Because it's not...
Right. Having children, he had
and exactly. And that's that next... The next Rashi, the next source on the sheet is the Rashi that says exactly that, where when Rachel asks Yaakov, have a libanim, and he responds like, what do you want from me? Hatachar Elohim Anochi. The Mefarshim all sort of ask, what do you mean? Like daven for her. That's what you're supposed to do when someone has a problem. Like, you know, of course there's something you can do to help. And Rashi says exactly what you said, that you said I should do what my father did, but I'm not like my father. He didn't have children at all. Yitzchak didn't have children at all. I have children, so I'm not in the same type of situation. But in fact, this doesn't seem to really address the problem, because the fact that he had children already, so what? So she doesn't, so daven for her. And the Maharal in the next source, in his super commentary on Rashi, the Gur Aryeh, comments on this. He explains Rashi. He asks exactly that question and says, V'im tomar uma bekach, v'chi bishvil zeh lo yitpalel aleha, like, so what? So that you can't daven for her because you already have children? V'nira mipnei sh'toldot ha'shvatim einan kishar toldot. Shekavanat Hashem Yitbarach lotzi dafka mi'isha zot v'lo mi'isha acheret. V'lakach lo haya rotza Yaakov l'shanot hadabar. Aval Yitzchak hayodeh shekol banav yiyo lo mi'isha zot shehi bat zugo l'kach yitpalel aleha. So he says that the birth of the Shvatim, the reason that Yaakov felt that he shouldn't daven for Rachel because he had other children, was because the birth of the Shvatim is not like when a regular person gives birth and has a child. The birth of the Shvatim was a national concern. It was part of Hashem's plan for the world. And therefore, Yaakov felt like he shouldn't really interfere. He doesn't know exactly how Hashem wants this to work out. You know, Rachel, Leah, like exactly how this is going to happen. He sort of felt like this isn't just about you and me. This isn't a personal issue where I can just daven for you because I feel bad for you. Like, there's something much bigger going on here, and I don't really, I don't want to try to ask Hashem to change whatever plan it is that he has. So the point here is, as you said, Hannah herself is in the same boat as, let's say, Sarah or Rachel, not as Rivka, but in the same boat as them, in the sense that she as an individual doesn't know whether she's going to have children. But at the same time, the genre of the tefillah of the Avot as a whole is entirely different from the genre of the tefillah of Chana, in that they are not just davening in a vacuum for their own personal needs. Their having children is a national concern and is a concern that they've already have received a promise from God about. In fact, there was an article that Rabbi Shalom Karmi wrote in Rinat Yitzchak about 20 years ago, in which he made this distinction, and he says that the type of tefillah of the Avot, he calls tefillat hayeud, the tefillah of destiny, because they ultimately knew what the answer was going to be. There was this national destiny at stake. Whereas the tefillah of Chana as an individual is a tefillat hada'aga. It's a tefillah of suffering and of her own individual pain, because she didn't know what the answer was going to be at the end. And so while in a certain way she seems to be in the same type of situation, it's actually fundamentally different in an important way. And if we look at the next source on the sheet, the Midrash from the Gemara and Brachos, it says that the Tidor Nedar, V'tomar Hashem Tzvakot, Amar Rabbi Elazar, Miyom Shebara HaKadosh Baruch Hu Et Olamo, Lo Haya Adam Shekra'o LaKadosh Baruch Hu Tzvakot, Ad Shebata Chana V'Krato Tzvakot. Amar Chana Lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu Ribono Shel Olam. So first the Gemara says that that Hannah initiated a new way, a new name for Hashem, a new way of calling out to him, and that she said to Hashem, is it really so hard for you to give me one child? Mashal lema hadavar doma, lemelech basar v'dam she'asa su'udah la'avada, ba'ani achad v'amad al hapetach, amar lahem tnu li prusa achat. There was a king who made a feast for his servants. One poor person came and he stood by the door and he said to the servants, please give me one piece of bread. V'lo hishgichu alav. They didn't pay attention to him. Dachak v'nechnas etal hamelech. So he pushed in and entered before the king. Amar lo adoni hamelech mikol su'udah she'asita kasha be'enecha liten li prusa achat. And he said directly to the king, from this entire fancy feast that you made, you can't give me one piece of bread? What's wrong with you? So this midrash, I think, brings into focus a number of important points about the story of Hannah that we're going to analyze. The first is what we said, that Hannah is not operating with the assumption that she has a promise from Hashem, or that she really deserves anything. I mean, she's a poor person at the feast. She's not coming in with any assumption that she has this coming to her, that she deserves it in any way, that she has any guarantee that Hashem will listen to her. She's pushing her way in through sheer force of personality. And the way she is, in contrast to the Avot and Imahud, who are acting on a promise from Hashem, she feels and she is like a poor person at the feast who wasn't invited, can't really assume that her request is going to be successful at all. And this midrash makes that point with emotional force by comparing her to that poor person knocking at the doors of the palace. The midrash brings a number of other aspects of the Hannah story and of Hannah's personality into focus as well. So one, related to what we already said, but a little different, is Hannah's loneliness. That the Midrash, when he compares her to a beggar who asks the servants of the king for bread, it seems reasonable to assume that the servants of the bread, the servants of the king in the Nimshal represent the other people in Hannah's life that she first turned to for support before she pushed her way into the king, before she pushed her way into Hashem. That they represent Elkanah and Penina and perhaps other people that she turned to for support also. And that these people really couldn't give her what she wanted, and that's why she felt forced to go into and stand in front of the king himself directly, in front of Hashem. And it's interesting to me that in Pshat, while Elkanah and Penina clearly have, in Pshat at least, have totally different feelings toward Hannah and totally different motivations, the way that they affect her and the way that their actions are described are actually parallel. If you look at the next source from Shmuel Aleph, starting in Pasuk He, it begins with, Ulechana yutan mana achat apayim, ki et Hannah ahav, v'Hashem sagar rachma. Elkanah gave Hannah an extra portion because he loved her, but Hashem had sealed her womb. And then it describes Penina's actions. V'chi astat sarata gam ka'as ba'avur harima, ki sagar Hashem ba'ad rachma. And her rival provoked her to irritate her, to hurt her, because Hashem had closed her womb. And I think that it could be argued that by the psukim framing their actions of Elkanah and Penina with parallel structure, with closing both psukim with the same words that Hashem sealed her womb, it's also paralleling the effect that they had on her. That even though Elkanah, gave her an extra portion and loved her, and Penina was trying to aggravate her, ultimately, in a way, those actions were parallel in the way that they affected Hannah. Because in the end, both of them made her feel her loneliness more intensely. Elkanah by sort of killing her with kindness, and Penina by being mean to her. Later on in the Pesukim, it becomes even more clear that they really have the same effect on her, in that when Elkanah says in Pasuk Chet, Halo anochi tov lach me'asara banim, aren't I better to you than 10 sons? What she immediately does, v'takam chana achrei ochla, she immediately goes and davens, because this phrase makes it clear to her that she's really on her own here. It makes her feel her loneliness and the sense that she really has to depend on herself to get this done, because once he says that, it's clear, like, he's not getting this, right? And that's, and many of the Mepharshim point this out, the Malbim in the next source says that, like, once he said that, she realized that she had to take it on herself to daven, because he made her feel her aloneness so deeply. And Penina as well, in the last pasuk I gave you there, pasuk Tetzayin, when Hannah is davening, the way she describes her emotional state to Eli is she says, "May rov sichi v'kaasi dibarti ad hena." I'm speaking out of my great kaas, And that was the same word that we saw that Pnina did to her, right? In Pasuk Vav, v'chi asta tzarata. I mean, Pnina was the person who made her feel that ka'as. It says explicitly in the words that Pnina made her feel that ka'as, and that ka'as was what propelled her to daven. So I think it's interesting that both the Pnina and Elkanah act like the servants of the king in this mashal. While they have totally different feelings toward her, and they have different motivations into totally different things, ultimately, her feeling after dealing with them is the same way that this ani in the mashal feels after dealing with all of the avdei hamelech, who say that you can't have a prusa achat. Because they both make her feel very alone in her quest to have a child, and therefore she feels propelled to daven. The Chana's loneliness in general is an important motif of her personality and of her story and of her tefillah. For example, you know, just to take an obvious example, she davened silently, which it's clear from Eli's response this was not the standard thing to do, and the Gemara and Brachot tells us that she's the person that this is how we learn that we should daven silently. It's interesting to me that her tefillah, by being very sort of individually centered, inwardly focused, she represents someone who believes in avoda that's very individual. And so, too, her son Shmuel rejects the concept of centralized authority and really wants all people to try to maintain that type of very personal, individual relationship with Hashem, not going through an intermediary of any sort. Whereas Eli, who represents institutional religion, being a religious authority and an emissary of others to God, his sons also represent institutional religion with all of its pitfalls, with the corruption that goes along with it. So we see how his sort of mode of avoda and her mode of avoda those are transferred to this conflict between the B'nai Eli and her son Shmuel. So there's a fundamental loneliness to Chana's tefillah, which defines it. But there's also something paradoxical and sort of ironic about her loneliness and her internal focus, which is that by being silent, which would seem to be like a very modest way of davening, she's actually being brazen because it broke with tradition, because people didn't daven that way. And that's sort of what that brings us to the other point in the Midrash as well, which is that this ani is crazy, right? He just pushes his way, like this beggar comes to the palace and like the servants tell him he can't have a piece of bread, so he just barges in front of the king. I mean, that's nuts, right? And so in the same way, this is another point that I think the Midrash is making that we see throughout Divrei Chazal in the way that they interpret Chana's tefillah, which is that she acts with a great deal of assertiveness, like to the point of confrontation even. What she does here is not the normal. This is not what you would normally expect, and this guy would be arrested. Like, this isn't like the normal, okay, the servant said no, so I just push my way in. Like, that's not the normal next step. And so, too, Chana's type of tefillah was also not really the normal next step. I think it's interesting to see, we're going to see a number of midrashim that sort of develop this take on Chana's tefillah, but before we do, I'd like to look into the pshat to sort of see what hints are there in pshat that led Chazal to read Chana's tefillah in this way of being very outspoken and to the point of brazenness, of confrontation. So I teach in this room, so I can't just talk the whole time. So I'd like to just take a few seconds, a minute, to look at the pshat, the next source I gave you, starting with Pasuk Yud and Parag Aleph, and see if you see any of the hints in pshat, if you come up with any ideas as to what it is in the words of the text that make Chazal read Chana's tefillah in this way. Raise your hand. Okay, good. That is one very important one. There are a number of them. That's a really important one. In that first pasuk, in Pasuk Yud, it says, V'hi marat nefesh v'atit palel al Hashem. Okay, but al has a confrontational connotation. It often means to be against someone. It is certainly not a standard usage with the verb lihit palel. And what's even more interesting is that if you look through the rest of the psukim, she does a lot of davening here, right? There's a lot of lihit palel with Chana. So if you look through the psukim, though, that word al doesn't come up again. In Pasuk Yud Bet, it says, here batali palel lifnei Hashem, which is somewhat more standard. This is after she's already made her nadar and promised, you know, that she's tried to ask Hashem for a child. And then even later in Pasuk Kavav, once Shmuel is already born, she says, ani ha'isha ha'nitzavet imcha bazel lihit palel el Hashem, which is an even more standard usage. So it almost seems as though she starts off in this very confrontational way with lihit palel al Hashem, and then, like, as she slowly gets what she wants more and more, she sort of reverts to this more and more, humble demeanor of like, no, it's really Leaf Nye, no, it's really Al, right? So as she gets what she wants more and more, she changes her demeanor somewhat. So I think that is an important one, and not just I think, it's clearly an important one in Chazal's mind, because in the next source after this, the Gemara says explicitly, Va'amar Rabbi Elazar, Chana hiticha dvarim klapei mala, Chana threw her words at Hashem, she'ne'emar v'titpalel al Hashem. Because of the Gemara, that is clearly one of the sources in Pshat that informed Chazal when they just chose to read Chana's Tefillah in this way. Any others? Yeah.
Well, it seems that it's a very, she has a sense of a very personal connection to Hashem.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's not insignificant, that it's Balachash, because it says, Nidabret Aliva, Veshkochet, Veshkochet Nafshi, what she pours out her heart, like it's very connected, not like a distant relationship.
Exactly, right. I think that's very important, that she's clearly speaking with a lot of emotion. Also in that pasuk we saw before in Ted Zion, when she says, Ki meirov sichi v'kasi dibarti ad hina, that also, when a person is speaking, v'ashpoch et nafshi, meirov sichi v'kasi, when a person describes her tefillah in that way, as coming out of such a deep sense of hurt and emotion, it is very logical to assume that the person may not have taken the most reasonable tone in expressing herself, right? And in fact, it's interesting, the next Gemara after that one that we just saw, does not quote this specifically, but it does tell the story that Chana said to Hashem, there are three mitzvot that women are specifically entrusted with, and that that there are sources that they die in childbirth, or they might die in childbirth if they don't do these mitzvot, challah, nidah, and hadlakas neros. And she says, I didn't break any of those mitzvot. Like, why aren't you giving me children? So now, this is not a rational argument. There's no promise or guarantee anywhere that if you do keep these mitzvot, you will have children. And I'm sure there have been countless nashim tzidkaniot throughout the ages who kept these mitzvot and were not blessed with children. But at the same time, the point is that the Gemara is making here is that she is speaking out of a very deep sense of emotion and hurt. And therefore, to assume that she may be expressing herself in a very forthright type of way is not a far stretch at all, that she may be making these types of arguments that come out of a lot of emotion rather than out of reason. Any other ideas? Yeah. Right, the fact that she makes a neder in Pasuk Yud Aleph. She's very forthright about it. She makes a neder and she says, Im ra'otir eba ani amatecha uzachartani v'lo tishkach, v'natati lamatecha zera nashim, etc. She's like making a deal with Hashem. And not only is she making a deal with Hashem, but the language that she uses, Imra Otira, if you really look carefully, God, Uzachartani v'lo tishkach, and you remember me, and then you don't forget me either, right? Then this is what's going to happen. I mean, she is speaking in a very forthright way. And the Gemara comments on that as well, in the source that's actually above this, which says, Amar Rabbi Elazar, Amra Chana lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, like, an insane midrash. It's like, really blows your mind. Ribono Shalom, im ra'o mutav, im lav tireh. The Gemara says that she actually says to Hashem, im ra'o, if you see what I'm going through and you give me a child, good, we're good. And v'im lav, if you don't see, tireh, you're going to see. Because what she goes on to say to him in this midrash, to Hashem, is, she said, if you don't give me a child, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go seclude myself with a man who's not my husband. I am not going to commit adultery, but I will make myself into a sota. My husband has the right to accuse me of being a sota and make me drink the mayim ha'ma'arim, but I won't have committed adultery. And you promised that if a woman who did not commit adultery drinks the mayim ha'ma'arim, she will be blessed with a child. So either way, you're going to give me a kid. Because if you imra'o, then good, you give me a kid. And if not, I'm going to make you give me a child. Okay, and I think that so it's a very forthright language that the Gemara is ascribing.
Just in the Midrash.
In the Midrash, exactly. But the Midrash, what's so interesting is how Chazal, read this type of tone into Chana's Tefillah, and I think it's exactly based on what Michal said, on the language of the Nezer, and that sort of very emphatic language of Imra O Tira Uzachartani Velo Tishkach, etc. One other hint in the text that I think also indicates this type of tone to Chazal is that the way she talks to Eli as well, in addition to the way she talks to Hashem, is very interesting. In Pasuk Tet Zayin, she says to him, Al titein et amatecha lifnei bat Bli'al. She refers to herself as amatecha, your servant. Then he says, okay, you're right, l'chila shalom, Hashem should give you what you want. And the next pasuk, after he basically gives her the bracha she was asking for, she says, "V'tomer tinsa shivchatecha chin ve'enecha." Let your shivcha find favor in your eyes. So shivcha also means servant, but often has a somewhat more subservient tone than ama. And so it's almost, again, that sort of like ah, lifnei el thing that we saw before, the same type of thing that she says with regard to Eli, that like, I'm your ama, but once you give me what you want, then I'll be your shivcha, right? It's a little, she takes a somewhat more subservient tone with him after she sort of gets what she wants. So I think it's very interesting to see that the way that Chazal read Hannah as really being very forthright does have very strong support in the text. I mean, they were reading the text very carefully, as of course they always did. What's interesting as well is while Chazal read Hannah in this light and see her as being very aggressive, at the same time there's not a tone or a note of censure or criticism in the way Chazal sees Hannah, which is atypical. Usually when Chazal, you know, sort of reinterpret someone's actions in this way, it's often because they do find something objectionable in that person's behavior. And Adarabba, with Hannah, she is held up as being the paradigm of tefillah. You know, as the next source says, like, how many important halachot we learn from Hannah. And in fact, we do. The Gemara goes on and on with all of the halachot of tefillah that we learn from Hannah. So why do you think that is? That Chazal, on the one hand, insist on casting her in midrash after midrash, they cast her in this light, and at the same time, they hold her up as being a paradigm of perfect, sincere tefillah. What in the text do you think makes Chazal, you know, while reading her in that way, also view her as being totally beyond reproach in her tefillah?
She's successful.
Okay, so one thing is she's successful, right? Hashem gives her what she wants, which indicates to them that she, you know, that she didn't do anything wrong, because Hashem didn't seem to have a problem with it. That's an important proof. But what would it be that would make Hashem not, like, why? Why do you think in Pshat that Hashem's not upset with her? Yeah.
Well, I don't know if this answers that question, but at the end, when she does want the child, then she gives up the child to Hashem. So it shows us that her motive was all along Hashem Shammai.
Okay, good. I think that's a really important point. The fact that she does something, while, as we said, she seems in certain ways parallel to the other Nashim HaKarot, she's really not. Because in addition to the fact that her situation was different in the Tfilat HaZa'aga versus Tfilat HaYe'ud way, her response is, she is the only one who really gives her child to Hashem, you know, physically, fully, not just in a spiritual way, but like actually walks him to, hands him over to Eli and lets him grow up in the Mikdash. And that sort of reflects that all along her kavanah was really l'shem shamayim, that even when she was davening for it. And it's interesting, the next source from Midrash Shmuel comments on has a similar idea, in that it comments on when she asks for Zera Anashim. And the Midrash comments on the fact that Anashim in Tanakh often doesn't just mean people like Stamazai. Anashim often means important people, people of chashivas. And in fact, the Midrash says, when she said Zera Anashim, she meant Anashim Nevonim, Anashim Nevi'im, Anashim Gedolim, Anashim Tzadikim. That's what she was asking for. And if you're reading this Midrash and you think, okay, that's really what Zera Anashim means, you're sort of like, don't just ask for a kid. Like, why are you asking for a Navi? Why are you asking for so much? And I think that the Midrash, which is the similar question to what we asked before, and I think the Midrash anticipates our question, because four lines up from the bottom of the Midrash, it introduces all of a sudden a mashal, sort of out of nowhere. The Midrash introduces us to a mashal. It says, Amar Rabbi Levi, le'achad yosheva oseh atara lamelech. It's a mashal to someone who's sitting and making a crown for the king. Avar chad v'chamte, amar lo ma'ata oseh, amar lo atara lamelech ani oseh. A passerby walks by and says, what are you making? He says, I'm making a crown for the king. Amar le kol ma sha'at yachul likboa ba avanim tovot margaliot kvaba, So the passerby says, all the jewels and beautiful things you can find, please put in the crown because it's going to be for the head of the king. Thus too, they said to Hannah, why are you asking for all for you know children who are going to be so exceptional, not just regular children? So she said, because it's Lishmo Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And when Hannah says this, she can sort of, it's not like when I say it's Lishmo Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right? Like, it really was Lishmo Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because she actually gave him to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And it's interesting in the Midrash that when it says, you know, before we said that in the other Midrash that the Avadim of the king seem to be the other people in the Hannah story, it's not clear who this passerby is. And in the Nimshal, when the Midrash goes into the Nimshal and says, Amru Lachana, it doesn't say who Amru. And it's not totally clear who is saying any of this to her. And I think that it's us. I think the Midrash is anticipating our question and saying that, like, as you're passing by and reading the story of Chana, you might really have this question about her. Let me tell you a story. And what the Midrash wants us to do is we become the passerby. The Midrash in the end wants us to be the ones to say to Chana, ask, go for it, ask for Nevi'im and Gedolim and Chachamim and everything else. It wants us to turn to Chana and say, like, we're totally fine with that, because we see in the end what your response is when you get that child. Yes.
As an individual, mm-hmm. but there's also, I think, an aspect of how she's seeing the crisis that Am Yisrael is at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Eli's sons were, like, he asked Chana when he sees her praying, are you drunk? Have you been drinking? Why would he think that? His sons were
right.
drunk, you know,
exactly.
Reverence, you know, that they mm-hmm. that they needed and that they should have had, in, you know, in their position. So, but she saw the corruption
mm-hmm.
that was rampant, and it even it was part of the.
Absolutely. And I think that's an important part of why she's asking not just for a regular child, but for such an exceptional child. Because of what you said, because she's not only looking for her own continuity, but because she has this other goal, as you said, a national goal as well. That's, if she just wanted a baby, she could just take a cute baby. She didn't need a nubby, right? So that's why she's, I think those two ideas are connected. The paradox of Chana's tefillah, which brings together this intense solitude and humility with a very forthright sense of expansiveness, sense of self, sense of, you know, a self-assertiveness, is symbolic of a paradox that's inherent within Rosh Hashanah as a Yom Tov in general, and very specifically, even more so, within Rosh Hashanah Shechalios B'Shabbos, as Rosh Hashanah is this year. The psukim in Tehillim that describe Rosh Hashanah refer to Rosh Hashanah as Bakesa. And there are a number of interpretations in the Gemara and Rishonim about what that word bakesa means. But the interpretation in the Gemara is that it refers to, it's connected to the word lechasot, kisui, covered, because the moon is covered on Rosh Hashanah. But this is not just a technical note about the moon. There have been, throughout Jewish thought, specifically in Hasidus, but in other Sfarim as well, there is an inherent connection between coveredness, hiddenness, mystery, and the Yom Tov of Rosh Hashanah. For one example, the Rav Huttner in his Sefer Pachad Yitzchak points out that there is something inherently covered and mysterious about Rosh Hashanah. And to give an understanding of what that is, there's much discussion of this in Hasidus. The Sfas Emes, who's the Ger Rebbe at the end of the 19th century, suggests that he points out that the other Yom Tovim, specifically the Shalosh Regalim, are inherently connected to the mitzvah of Re'iyah, of going up Aliyah L'Regal, being, you know, seeing Hashem in Yerushalayim, being seen by Hashem in Yerushalayim, and with a sense of sight, specifically, that's referred to as Re'iyah. Whereas Rosh Hashanah is clearly more connected with the sense of hearing, with Shmiyas Kol Shofar, that's the mitzvah that defines Rosh Hashanah. And seeing is obviously a much more external, like sort of objective type of mitzvah. It's like you're seeing something in front of you, as opposed to the sense of hearing, which is something far more internal. Along the same lines, but not within the Hasidic school, the Reb Chaim very famously explains that that's why the mitzvah of shofar requires kavana, because it's such an internal mitzvah that's dependent on a person's hearing something, that it's not sort of objective enough unless you have the kavana to be yotze that classifies it as a mitzvah. So the same way that Chana's prayer represents sort of solitude and loneliness in a very inwardly directed avodah, so too the Yom Tov of Rosh Hashanah, as connoted by that word bakesa and as symbolized by the mitzvah of shofar, also represents a avodah that's lonely and solitary and deeply internal, and about sort of trying to inculcate in ourselves the sense of subservience to Hashem as king. In Hasidic thought as well, Rosh Hashanah Shechalios B'Shabbos represents an entirely new type of avodah. The Shemi Shmuel is the second Sachet Shavar Rebbe. I gave you these sources, by the way, the Sfas Emes and the Shemi Shmuel, but we're not going to read them inside because we don't have time. And anyway, it's more fun to read it yourself. The Shemi Shmuel, who was the second Sachet Shavar Rebbe, who lived at the beginning of the 20th century, says, comes up with an explanation of Mishnah and Avos, and he says, somewhat common idea in Jewish thought, that there are two approaches to developing closeness with Hashem. One can approach Hashem through a sense of humility and sort of the lowliness and nothingness and shamefulness of man, or one can approach Hashem through a sense of the grandeur and potential and promise of being human. In a certain way, Rosh Hashanah really brings together both of these avodos, in the sense that while we are trying to be subservient to Hashem and inculcate humility within ourselves, we clearly, doing tshuva is predicated on a sense that we have a lot of potential and promise within us. But at the same time, I would say that Rosh Hashanah primarily focuses on developing that sense of servitude and humility more than on the grandeur and promise aspect. And certainly in the tefillot of Rosh Hashanah, that is the overriding theme, is our subservience and our sort of our nothingness as compared to Hashem. Shabbos, by contrast, represents an entirely different type of avodah. That Shabbos, first of all, is of course the day of great joy. It doesn't have that somber feeling of Rosh Hashanah. But in addition, the whole reason that we keep Shabbos, that we rest on Shabbos, is that we're emulating Hashem who rested on Shabbos. So just even by keeping Shabbos at all, we're sort of reminding ourselves of the grandeur of man, of how we can even try to imitate God. And so according to the Shemi Shmuel and some other Hasidic writers as well, the reason, the sort of the philosophical reason that underlies the halacha of why we don't blow shofar on Shabbos is that shofar and Shabbos sort of contradict each other. They're two entirely different approaches to avoda, an avoda that's based on a sense of greatness and in a sense of loneliness that can't really coexist together. With the exception that in the Mikdash, they were tokei a shofar b'Shabbos. And the Shemi Shmuel has a very beautiful line toward the end of the source that I gave you, where he says, "Ach b'mikdash hu inyan acher, ki ha-mikdash hu libad kol alma, v'hu ha-nekuda ha-pnimit na'ala mikol ha-tachim." That the Mikdash represents the heart of man. That just as the Mikdash was the geographical center of religious observance for the Jews, so too it symbolizes our center of religious observance, the human heart. And that within a person's heart, on an internal level, you know, human nature is defined by paradoxes and contradictions and conflicting emotions. And that when we focus very internally, those types, a sense of lowliness and a sense of grandeur actually can coexist. That's a lot of what being human is about, is reconciling those very contradictory types of emotions and feelings within our experience. So Chamas Tefillah represents this paradox of Avodat Hashem in bringing together humility and assertiveness. And in the same way, Rosh Hashanah, and especially Rosh Hashanah Shechal Yos B'Shabbos, represents the same paradox. So my hope is that by looking to Tefillat Chana as a paradigm, we'll be able to approach Rosh Hashanah to build an avoda that is internal and very honest and real and authentic and sincere, and that allows us to synthesize all of the wonderful complexity that makes us human. Have a ksiva v'chasima tova. Thank you.